My name's Michael the Ski Bomb, and I'd like to thank you for coming to another episode of Spotlight Interview. Today we have a couple treats. First of all, our guest is a very interesting young lady, Miss Jean Parker, better known as Kitty Cat 3000. During the interview, we have a new interviewer. His name is Lou Liotta. A lot of you know him from doing earlier sections of this program. We'd also at this time like to wish Steve Pellett a speedy recovery. We miss him here at Spotlight. Also, thanks to Dennis for recording this session. That being said, I'm going to turn it over to Lou to conduct the rest of the interview. It's all yours, Lou.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FTP Presents and Spotlight. The Spotlight is a program which comes to you every 2 weeks as a regular basis, or sometimes it's irregular, but it does come. And Spotlight, I think the purpose of it, as it originally designed, was to bring to FTP members individuals, men and women who are conducting their lives in an interesting way and have accomplished a great deal, but yet have had tragedy, have had disappointment, but nevertheless have carried through with their desires, their wishes, and have exhibited their talents in what they have done and what they continue to do. Today, we have an interesting person who is still conducting her life in an interesting manner and in an interesting place and accomplishing things which I guess most of us would like to accomplish. And she has succeeded. It is a she, and her name is Jean Parker. And Jean is an American who is living abroad at the current time, and she will tell you more about that, who has lived abroad. Her profession, really, there are many things she has done, but right now she is a freelance radio journalist and a college teacher who teaches journalism in a foreign country, and a woman who currently has been covering the tsunami disaster, and you will hear some of that later, one of her reports. In fact, today we're going to have some audio surprises, and actually we're going to begin with one, so just relax, see if you can figure out what's going on, because it is different. You've never heard anything like this before, so you will have to think about it and guess what you're hearing. So with that kind of a hook, we're going to begin. And are you ready, Jean? Are you there?
Yes, I am. What would you do if I wasn't here? Yes, I'm ready.
If you weren't there, I would just ad-lib for another 5 minutes or longer. I did it all my life.
Not for another hour and a half, I hope. That would be tough. Stand by 1 minute. Is the sound of the place where I live. And I know some people know where it is, but I live in Pune, India, and that's a typical street corner. The sounds that you would hear on a street corner, you can hear that a lot of the vehicles are very old, not maintained very well. One of the sounds you heard that sounded kind of like a motorcycle is what's called an auto rickshaw, and that's the modern-day kind of rickshaw that we have in most of India, but there are still manually operated rickshaws found in some places as well.
Well, this is Lou again, and I'm in America. I don't think I could have identified those sounds, but after all, that is India, Puma, India, and right now it's about 11:30 at night, I believe. Is that right, Gene?
Yeah, it's just after 11:30 p.m.
So we're not going to keep you up too late, but we're going to keep you up for a while. Now, you are currently a radio freelance journalist. I'm not sure that we all know what that is. Do you prepare stories and then try to sell them to the BBC, which you have done? Or do you prepare stories and try to sell them to NPR, which you've already done, or to other major outlets? How does a freelance journalist get his or her work before the public?
Well, normally how it works, Lou, is that you send a story pitch, and everything these days is done by email, which is what makes my job possible, actually. And you send a story pitch to an editor. Hopefully it's an editor you already have a relationship with. And the editor comes back and says, yes, we like this story, or no, this isn't going to fit with our plans for the near future. And if they like the story, then depending on the program, I would do everything from the initial contacts and setting up the interviews, conducting the interviews, doing the mix, doing the editing, and so forth, and then sending it to the editor over the internet using FTP usually. If they say, no, this really isn't something that we're interested in right now, then I shop it around and find another place that might be interested in it. And occasionally I get something that is not accepted by an editor, and if it's something that's what we call evergreen, meaning that it has a long shelf life, then I just put it I keep a list. I was going to say I put it in the back of my mind, but I keep a list of the audio I have available and also the story ideas that I have. And I keep track of what various programs are playing, and 6 months down the road, I might pitch it again. And so it's a question of keeping track of who's playing what the priorities are of the program or the network or whatever, and pitching accordingly so that you don't waste your time.
Now, you are being paid for these stories, and you say you're pitching them, you're sending some outline of what you'd like to do or what you have done and try to get it sold. What major stories have you done? Now, I know you don't do breaking news, you do feature stories, but which ones could you tell us briefly that you've done that we might have even heard and not recognized you?
Well, I do breaking news on occasion. I don't like to do it. I prefer to do long-form radio, which would be features and documentaries. So I've actually covered a lot of issues. When I lived in the States, I covered forest fires in the West. I did a couple of features on the 9/11 incident. Oh, let's see. I have done some in-depth features for The World, which is a BBC production, BBC and Public Radio International. And I've done a lot of documentaries and features on landmines. And some of that has been aired on places like Armed Forces Radio or The Health Show. I've had a number of pieces on a program called 51%, which is a women's program. All of these are carried by over 200 stations. And I've had a number of pieces on a program called Prime Time, which is funded by the AARP. And that's a fun program to work for because basically you can pitch them anything, and they define themselves very broadly. So I've done a few things for All India Radio. And what I've been working on recently, of course, which is what everybody in this part of the world has been working on, is the tsunami event. I have also done a number of, well, actually quite a few cultural stories from India that I've had aired in various places, both in the U.S. and in Europe.
Well, we're gonna give you a clip of one of Gene's tsunami stories later in the program, but not right now. Gene, you're based in India. You've been there for 4 years, I think you told me. But you've done stories all over the world. Could you give us some idea of some of the places you've been without, you know, a really exhaustive list, but some of the places you've been and the problems you might have had getting there or getting out or getting the story?
Well, let's see. I have reported from Nepal, and of course, that's not really possible at the moment. Nepal is closed, and in fact, life is very dangerous for journalists there at the moment. I've reported from Latin America, and one of the things I did years and years ago was human rights violation documenting during the Central American wars in the 1980s. And so I went to places like Guatemala and El Salvador and other places to report on what was going on in terms of people's experiences in with human rights violations. And that's actually where I began to figure out that I had the ability to facilitate the telling of other people's stories who, for various reasons, political reasons, technical reasons, economic reasons, didn't have the resources to do it themselves. And so I could use technology and my connections to facilitate their telling of their stories. I remember being in a weaving co-op in the countryside in Guatemala, and I met a fellow in there, and he was doing the same kind of thing on videotape, using videotape, where he would take videos of a community, and he was working with indigenous communities at the time. He was editing those tapes and then using them to educate the community about itself, so a kind of a look in the mirror. And the projects he was working on were very successful, and the community members could look at that and say, oh, wow, that's what we're like. And they could celebrate their accomplishments, and they could also list the improvements that they wanted to make. But it gave them a way to have an outside point of view. And so I have done the same thing with radio, mostly with radio, using audio.
That's good. I want to get into an area that I think you might want to tell us something about. You said you were in Central America during the 80s. And, of course, that was the era, the Reagan era, where the Sandinistas were opposing the government in Nicaragua. And, of course, the United States was assisting the government with outside forces, with outside materials. Were you in Central America at that time, and how did you report that story?
Carefully. Yes, I was there at that time. I was there several times during those years. Well, of course, it was a very tricky area, and so there were a lot of precautions we had to take at that time in terms of reporting the stories. We had to use pseudonyms for most of the people that we discussed. We had to, not discuss specific locations. A lot of the interviews that I did were clandestine, and were not places that could be disclosed, and so there were a lot of security precautions had to be taken in order to protect the people who were giving the interviews. I remember sitting down to interview a priest, and he was someone who was under government surveillance in a place, and he had what was called an accompaniment at the time, and at the particular time I was there, it was a couple who was his accompanying task force for 1 year. Their commitment was for 1 year, and I went to sit beside him to conduct the interview so that I could shift the microphone appropriately, and they said, no, you can't do that. It's our job to protect him, to sit either side of him, and so you'll have to figure out some other way to do that. So I was not permitted to sit any closer to the individual than these people would allow. So that kind of thing really, he was a marked man, and was somebody that a lot of people wanted assassinated. And so that kind of thing was very common.
Well, I remember that era very well, and I was unalterably opposed to the American foreign policy in Central America. I only say that to give my position. Did you feel that your stories were being censored in any way by the American government or the CIA or some of the local regimes in Central America?
Well, without going into too much detail, Lou, I was threatened by the CIA at one point. As far as censorship, most of these stories were aired in places that weren't interested in being censored, and so they would be outlets, news agencies that would, as much as possible, not permit censorship of their content.
I see, but the way you were reporting those stories was not welcomed by certain American governmental agencies, as you said, like the CIA. You said you were threatened. Were you threatened by anyone else? Or I might ask this. Did you feel at any time when you were working in Central America that your physical safety was in jeopardy?
Oh, all the time. That's a fact of life there at that time. And still to this day in El Salvador, there are some people who say that the criminal activity has made El Salvador a lot worse than it was even during the war. I haven't been back there in recent years, and so I can't attest to that personally, but I've heard that from a number of people. So, yeah, that's a fact of life.
Now, when you did those stories, when you went to Central America from the United States, how did that come about? You know, without getting into too much specific detail, but just how did an American woman journalist, and you have many other credentials, we'll get to those later, how did you find yourself in Central America? Was it because of the human rights cause that you espoused, or was it economics, or what was it?
Well, Lou, I've always been curious about things, and at one point I was involved in a project that collected mobility materials for people with disabilities. So they'd be stuff like crutches, canes, other kinds of simple material goods for an organization called the the Organization of Disabled Revolutionaries. And I decided not too far into that project that I really had to go and find out who the Organization of Disabled Revolutionaries were. And so I did. And I hooked myself up with a delegation, a documenting delegation, comprised of both journalists and human rights advocates, or simply people who wanted to know more about the situation. A lot of money then was going to the Contras, and so the whole region was engaged in a highly secretive, covert action on the part of the U.S. government. So a lot of the people who would participate in these things were people who just wanted to know more. And so that's how I got there. And then I later worked in Costa Rica, which is at the moment a stable country, has been for many years. And during that time was the one place in Central America where you could say there was any hope.
Well, what, Gene, what, I understand what took you to Central America. What took you to the place you are now, in Pune, India?
Well, I became a widow about 7 years ago. And after everything was settled and things were taken care of and so forth, I decided I needed a change, and I decided that it should be a big change. So I was kind of burned out on the work I was doing in the States. I had friends in India. I had visited India and knew about it. And so I decided to give it a try. So I actually made two or three separate trips to India before I moved here, before I relocated to here. And then I put my stuff in a bunch of suitcases and bought a plane ticket and left.
I might add here that Jean is multilingual. She, of course, speaks English, as you've heard. She speaks Spanish fluently, and she has learned Hindi. And maybe a couple other Indian languages, because there are hundreds of dialects in India. Now, where you are now, I just want to briefly go over the teaching career. You're teaching journalism at two colleges in India. Could you briefly say something about that, and then we'll get into how you actually do your work and some of the technology you use?
Yeah, I teach on the university level, radio journalism, and I teach at the Symbiosis Institute, which is an elite college here in India, a very well-known college throughout this part of the world. And I also teach at something called the New Media Institute, and then I teach at a couple of other places on occasion. They'll have me come in and do some kind of module or something, you know, some particular thing. And but when I teach the full course, I've designed a full semester course in introductory radio journalism. And it's important to understand the context of radio here. A lot of people listen to radio, but in fact, radio in India is quite restrictive. Up until recently, the only radio that's been allowed is state-owned radio. So people listen to shortwave, and now they have cable and so forth, but and they have satellite. But up until 3 years ago, really, there was no private FM radio. There was only All India Radio, which is the state radio. And so with the introduction of the private FM stations and the expansion of the FM stations, and also the hopeful inevitability of community radio and campus radio in India, all of a sudden I found myself with a set of skills that were in demand. And I didn't come here to plan to teach. In fact, one of the reasons I came here was to do a PhD program in communications and development. Well, I still haven't done that. I went to Symbiosis and I spoke with them about doing the PhD there, because they're a very well-known college. And they said, okay, that's all fine and everything, and we'd love to have you, but in the meantime, would you mind teaching some classes? We don't have anybody here that's got any expertise in radio. And radio in India is changing. We need somebody that can teach some curriculums on that. So I said I would, and I've been so busy doing that ever since. I haven't done anything about my PhD, but I will when it's time. So I teach people about the history of radio, what it sounds like in different parts of the world. I do practical courses on interviewing skills, and I do some voice training, news reading, reading aloud kinds of exercises. Let's see, we work on script writing. We do field recording, different interview styles and so forth. Oh, anything that would be in an introductory course in radio journalism.
Well, I hope I'm as good as some of the beginning students you have. But we have a lot of techies who listen to Search to Spotlight. And I wonder if you could briefly feed their appetite for knowledge about what does she use, what equipment does she use, what hardware, what software. Could you briefly tell us something about that?
Yeah, sure. A few years ago I decided to get rid of my PC, and I do everything on a fairly high-end laptop. There were a lot of reasons for that, a lot of logistical reasons and so forth. Everything was always on the wrong computer and all, and having the laptop makes things much, much more efficient. And I have a big disk drive here in my flat that I back it up on, because I carry it on my motorcycle, so it's a bit risky. And so I have to make sure everything is backed up properly. I use JAWS for screen reading software. I use a Braille light for note taking. And by the way, Braille is very important. I use Braille all the time, every day. I do my recording and editing on SoundForge, and so it is a PC platform, of course. I use Minidisc to do my field recording. And I have a bunch of, what are they? MZR50s, Sony MZR50 Minidisc machines that I use, because they're the most accessible of the inaccessible Minidisc machines. Anyone who's worked with the portables knows what I'm talking about. I use an external sound card. I use one of the Eteral UA20 sound cards through the USB port. What else? I don't know. I've got a bunch of microphones. I've got a phone patch here. I think that's the major... I think that's majorly what I use. I do have a broadband connection here, and if you're in an urban area now in India, it's quite possible to get a broadband connection.
Okay, I hope that satisfies the techies. Now for the rest of us, I'm sure you're asked this many times in different ways, but Jean is visually impaired. She does not have any vision. She's in a strange country, strange culture. The distances are great. Of course, there is good communications there. They have trains and they have cars. But would you tell us what it takes to mount a project to get a story? Let's say in southern India. How would you go about doing that? And the personnel you would use, the people you would hire, that kind of thing. You can stretch out on that a bit.
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, communications are good, but they're not. I'll try to explain what I mean by that. Probably the biggest divide in this country, and there are lots of divides, but the biggest ones are gender and location in terms of rural and urban. So let me just take you through a scenario of putting a story together, and I'll introduce some of the some of the issues that come up. Because there are many. One, of course, is language, and there are many languages throughout India. And even people in India who have lived here all of their lives cannot go to another part of the country without having usually some kind of language problems. Depending on who you're dealing with, of course, if you're dealing with the business sector and some of the elite members of society, then they will have some English, and some of them will have very good English. But if you deal with the people I do, which are the common people, the ordinary, everyday people, that's who I'm interested in talking to, they won't have any English at all, and sometimes they won't have Hindi either. So in South India, that's true, because there's a historic conflict between the Tamil speakers and the Hindi speakers about what should be the national language in India. And so most people in Tamil Nadu, which is a state in South India, are anti-Hindi, and so they won't use Hindi. Even if they know it, they won't use it. And as I said, most of the people I deal with are not English speakers. So that leaves some things that need to be done. And one of the things that anthropologists and sociologists and all will tell you is that if you want to talk with ordinary people, everyday people, about their lives, you need a mediator. You need somebody who is trusted by those people to give you entree into those communities, and that's extremely important here. You can't do anything without that mediator into particular caste or the particular religious group or the particular geographic area that you want to work in. And so what I do is I usually hire somebody as a mediator who is also a journalist and usually a writer, because a lot of people here are writers, local writers. So in the budget for a radio program, you know, there are always items for travel expenses and lodging expenses and production ancillary help and so forth, because you have to have those things, and sometimes you need engineering help as well, but you have to have those things. And so I put into my budget a line item for this person. And in this country, often you have to rent a vehicle, and you can't rent a vehicle without a driver. So you know, a lot of things that you have to pay for that you might not pay for in the U.S., but then, of course, prices are lower. So anyway, those are normal things that anybody, be they blind or sighted, would pay for and would hire in doing a story like this. Well, what I do differently, though, is I hire somebody that I think will be able to not only give me entree to the community and explain what's going on in the community, but also explain to me what's going on visually. And I've had good success at doing this. I am a person that likes to experience things and touch things, and so I do that as much as I can when I'm doing my stories. But, you know, there are always things that that I need information on, for example, that is totally visual, like the expression on somebody's face, for example. Or their body language. And so I give the people that I hire very clear direction on what I want to know from them about those aspects. And so their job is to coordinate, set up the interviews. I rely on them. I tell them what I'm looking for, what kind of people I want to interview, what the story should sound like, and I give them very careful instructions on who the people are I'm looking for. And then when we're ready to go, I go and do the story, pay everybody off, and take the material and edit it, come back. And then I just edit the story, put the tracks together, write the script and so forth, and we go through the editing process, whatever the program is that I'm doing. But the point is that in a society like this, there is a need for a lot of collaborating for everybody. And so it lends itself to somebody who's a blind person who is doing this kind of work, because everybody has drivers, everybody has personal assistants, everybody has those kinds of support factors. And so it isn't at all unusual.
Well, that was excellent. Thanks, Jean. I want to make an assumption here. I'm making an assumption. You said that you hire someone to give you descriptions of perhaps the buildings, the people, the expressions, the gestures. Can I assume that you had vision at one time and lost it, and that's why you key in on those things that those of us who have seen miss or feel deprived of it when we don't get them?
No, I did not have vision at one time. And the reason that I want visual information is because I can get the auditory information using the senses that I have. But in order to give a well-rounded profile of a description of what's going on, I need to be able to describe, for example, what a place looks like that's been swept out to sea. I need to be able to describe what does someone look like who is sitting in the mud and looking at where her house used to be for the first time and seeing there's nothing there. And so those descriptions are important in radio to give the listener a well-rounded scene, if you will, of what's going on with people, and to make them as human as possible and as compelling as possible.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, and I'm glad my assumption was wrong, because it brings out a point that I think probably should be made. And that is that we as blind individuals living in a sighted world must adapt ourselves and our material and our information to the audience, which is in the majority, which is sighted. And intellectually, you understand that, and you achieve that in your work, and I think you're to be congratulated, because it is important. It is important to your audience, and I guess it's important to you if you want to reach that audience. Gene, I'm going to switch gears here in a moment and get into your life and your education, but I want to give you a breather, so take this as a breather. The FCC doesn't regulate us, but I want to sort of give a station break here. I'm, for those who came in late, and I don't know who came in late, but I'm speaking to Gene Parker, a freelance radio journalist and teacher. I guess we could call you a world traveler, a woman, a person who enjoys adventure, who has very strong views about human rights, right and wrong. And I'm delighted to have you with us today, and I'm sure the audience is enjoying your information and your thoughts and your feelings. And I guess what I want to move to now is, who is Jean Parker? Where did she come from? Where did she go to school? Don't give them all those colleges you went to, though. Just a few of them. But could you give us something like that? I hope I gave you enough time to catch your breath, Jean.
Yeah, I did go to too many colleges. Originally came from New England. Actually, I came from not very far where Lou himself grew up, as we discussed when we were talking before. I came from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I went to school at Perkins for the first 5 years of my education, and then I transferred to the public school. The state of New Hampshire at that point had created a program to accommodate kids with that were blind in public school. So I was one of the first in the state to be able to take advantage of that. And so I graduated from my local public high school and so forth. I graduated from the University of Maine at Farmington with a degree in rehabilitation. And then I, later on, actually, I got a master's degree from Colorado University in counseling. And by the way, I used to think that my education was totally irrelevant to what I do now. But I'll tell you that a lot of the skills I learned in school for counseling I use in interviewing today. A lot of the skills in how to engage people and so forth. So I don't think education is ever irrelevant, even if you go into a profession that's totally unrelated to what your education was. There's always something that you take away from it that's useful.
Well, that was good, because many times we get into controversies here, not in the, on this show, but sometimes in the chat rooms we discuss which is better, to have attended a school, a residential school for the blind, and be sort of out of the mainstream, or to go to a public high school with sighted colleagues and students, and which is better, that endless discussion. Well, I guess we've all decided it depends on the individual. But those early years in a residential school for the blind do teach important skills, and you mentioned one, Braille. Braille literacy is important in the professions, in your profession and the profession I used to have. So I'm glad that you saw both sides of it, and I know you you have a balanced view of that. Without touching sore spots, bringing up bad memories. Of course, you went to school in Colorado, and you had a social life, and you met an individual who you married and lived with and were happy with, and unfortunately, he passed away. Could you tell us something about that side of your life? Without going into, you know, infinite detail, but just touch upon that tragedy in your life.
Yeah, well, it was a sudden death, and I was actually traveling. I was working for Radio for Peace International in Europe, and I had been working in Italy and then gone to the Netherlands. I was working in Amsterdam, in Rotterdam. And so it was totally unexpected. It was a massive stroke. And I don't remember much about the journey from Amsterdam to back to the U.S. because I had taken tranquilizers. But I do know that the airline staff was very good and extremely cooperative. They broke a lot of rules for me, and because I it was an emergency and I had to get back in a hurry. And so after that, it was very much a question of, you know, settling legal issues, getting things straightened out. He was a pack rat, and so I had all of his papers to deal with, and a whole house full of stuff and what to do with it. And, you know, that took a couple of years to really sift through everything and get it squared away. And so, you know, it took a lot out of me, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah, and I think you told me he was a successful mining engineer who had a career, and he was very supportive of your career, which was quite different than his. Now, you're living in India, and come back from that tragedy, that personal tragedy, that disappointment. It hasn't all been up in success for you, one success after another, but you've rebuilt your life and you've found someone compatible. Would you like to say something about your doctor friend?
Yeah. Actually, he's at the hospital right now seeing to someone who had a brain hemorrhage yesterday, I think it was. Yeah, he's a medical doctor, and he's someone that I met on one of my earlier visits to India before I had relocated, although I had planned to relocate here anyway, even before we met. His practice is in a group of villages that is some distance from here, and it's a group of remote villages that is in a place with a road that's barely navigable, and actually for a good part of the year there's no road at all. And so he's the only healthcare access provider that these people have, and they live pretty much as they have for the last 2,000 years. Not much has changed there. And one of the interesting things about India is that even though it isn't that far from here, it's some distance, but it isn't that far, maybe it's 50 miles, there's a stark contrast between the urban life and the rural life. And as I said earlier, that's one of the biggest divides in this country, is both gender and rural versus urban lifestyle. And so I go with him when I can, when my schedule permits. I go with him to the villages, and we have a house there which costs us $6 a month to rent. it's a very interesting experience to go to the village, and it's in stark contrast with the work that I do here.
Now, I'm not sure if you said you lived in a house or an apartment. Maybe you'd like to tell us something about your domestic situation there, how a person with your education, your class, your ethnicity lives in India. What kind of servants, what kind of help do you get, so that people can understand the way a Western person who is a professional lives in India?
Well, it's really any person. I really actually don't live much of a Western lifestyle. There are certainly aspects of my possessions and my lifestyle that could be considered Western. But at the moment, Western is in India. So there are a lot of people, native Indians, who live much more Westernized lives than I do. I live on the fourth floor of a seven-story building, an apartment block, in an area called Kondwa. It's in South Pune. And it's quite a new area. Over the last 15 years, perhaps. A lot of construction going on in Pune right now, a lot of building. And so this is a new building. I pay $70 a month rent, or 3,500 rupees. And there are, let's see, there's one bedroom and a living room, which is called the hall, and a kitchen, and a bathroom, and then a separate toilet room and a balcony. And I live here with William, my partner, and his niece lives here. And on occasion there are also patients that stay here. And when somebody comes from the village, for example, and they don't have relatives here and they don't have any contacts, they need a place to stay while they're getting treatment. And so oftentimes there are people staying here. Let's see, what else can I tell you about it? We have a semi-automatic lift, meaning that the lift itself is automatic, but the gates And doors are open by hand. We have, at the moment we have electricity 21 hours a day, usually. Sometimes less than that, but usually it's about that. And let's see. Outside of this building is an auto stand, a rickshaw stand, where you can get a rickshaw to go anywhere in Pune. There's also a bus stand not too far away. And the market area is maybe, oh, not quite a quarter of a mile away. It's on a roadside of a busy street called Solanke Vihar Road. Certain parts of the market appear and disappear at different times of day. And but then there are also shops and stalls along the roadside that are more permanent.
Yes, that answers that question very well. Thank you, Jean. And I was, you have servants that help you shop and do some cleaning because you're busy with your profession, your teaching, your radio broadcast, gathering materials. And that's not uncommon, I think you told me, to have servants. And, of course, you're assisting these people to make a living. You mentioned something here about a motorcycle. What's that all about? That's nothing you drive, is it?
No. No. Either William drives it or somebody drives it. Sometimes I hire somebody to drive it. I have a motorcycle and a Jeep. And so depending on where I need to go and so forth, those two vehicles are available. I also use public transit. And as you know, we have a very elaborate railway system in India. And so if you go any place of any distance, usually you would take a train. And everybody takes public transit. It's not at all unusual. Everyone does. And so there are a lot of aspects of it that are common denominators, I guess you could say, of things. So, for example, most people don't drive a vehicle, or if they do have a driving license, it's for a motorcycle but not a four-wheel vehicle. That's very common also. And so it's not unusual at all to not have a private vehicle or to need a ride or something. Some people have drivers, hire drivers. The lifestyle lends itself to a number of benefits that are not available in the West. Of course, the fact that I have dollars is a big factor in a lot of that, and I realize that. It's called the guilty pleasures of the expat life. And it's something that people who live in other countries have to deal with all the time, is that there are some privileges that we have, and we have to, in my view anyway, be mindful of what those privileges are and use them appropriately and not take advantage of the or misuse the privileges that we have. But it does make things a bit tricky. And I can actually do my work differently here. I can hire co-producers. I can hire people to do the parts of the work that are either visual or things I'm just tired of doing, you know. And the reason it works for me is because I know that I can do them myself. And so I have chosen to have other people do certain tasks for me that I know I can do myself. But I've made a conscious choice by saying, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. And somebody else can do this and can get paid for it. And so where it doesn't work is where someone has never been expected to do these things for themselves, and they grow up being pampered and very spoiled. And that happens with blind people in this country who are from upper-class families a lot, where they grow up sometimes with an overabundance of servants, and they never learn to do anything for themselves.
Yeah, that leads me to another question that I'm sure you are prepared to answer. You know, as Americans and as blind people, we often think in this country that we're, you know, that we look at the employment statistics, 50 to 70% of American blind people are unemployed, they're on welfare, they're on Social Security, they have limited funds, they're living in poor areas, they don't have access to computers. They're not getting vocational assistance. There's a lot of complaints. Gene, tell them what the life of the blind is in Asia and throughout most of the world.
Well, it depends a lot. I would say, well, in my observation, there are a few people who do have access to computers, who are connected, who have good jobs, either in government or in corporations, and some that have very unusual jobs. And I'm always amazed to talk with people in various places, blind people or people who have other disabilities, who have very unique and unusual professions. But for the most part, this is a part of the world where, if you're blind, you don't have a lot of prospects, and unless you're very creative and very confident in yourself and you have a lot of family support, there just aren't the choices or the role models that are needed in order to help blind people understand that there are different ways of doing things rather than sitting on the roadside begging for money, or going through the trains begging for money, which is what a lot of blind people do here. And it's very difficult. It really goes along the lines of family background and education, although there are certainly a lot of wealthy blind people who don't do a thing with their lives, and there are a lot of very poor blind people who have made very successful lives out of what they have. But for the most part, in this part of the world, the lives of blind people are quite miserable and quite deprived, and not what one would think of as very pleasant or successful. Most people make a hand-to-mouth existence by begging for food or begging for money or doing some other kind of asking for charity. And so The blind people in a country like this face a lot of problems. There's a lot of poverty here. And so for people who have a disability, for a poor family, it's one more burden, it's one more problem. And so a lot of people get turned out of their families. And fortunately, there is quite a good network of residential schools for the blind in India. Some of them are quite limited as far as the quality of education that they give and the conditions where that the kids are living in. But there is at least a chance to get some kind of a basic education. And then, of course, there are the few elites that go on to university or go abroad or something and are able to join the mainstream workforce.
Thank you. We're coming now to the... We're approaching the end of the quote interview, and I'm wondering if you would cue up that piece that you had, that 5-minute piece, giving an example of your journalism, your journalistic style. And I'll just carry the ball here for a while until you're ready. But I think I've been struck by your individuality, your adventurousness, your adaptability, and of course your intelligence, but more than your intelligence, your social intelligence, to fall into these different cultures, Latin America, India. You spend time in the Arab Emirates. You've been all over. And you function smoothly. Yes, you make mistakes. You've admitted that to me. We all make mistakes. But generally speaking, you've built a life which is unusual, even if you had perfect vision and perfect resources. You've built a life, and it's an unusual one. It's a successful one. Not without tragedy, not without disappointment, but you bounce back, and I admire that, and I think my hat is off to you. And if you have that clip ready, if you could play it now. If you haven't, I'll carry water for a little longer.
Well, I do have it ready, Lou, and that's no problem. This is a piece that I did for the World Vision Report about a month ago, and this was done soon after, well, let's see, maybe 2 weeks after the tsunami, I guess. The World Vision Report is funded by World Vision, which is a very large NGO. It's a Christian relief organization, but they do not have any editorial control or editorial influence on the program. It's quite a good show about development, actually. And so this is about a 5.5-minute segment, I think. And I'm going to play it from the top of the show because it's the first piece in the show at the in the first segment of the show. So what you'll hear first is the host, who is Peggy Waymeyer, I think is how her name is pronounced, introducing the program, giving the lineup and all. And then it goes into the piece that I did. So here it comes.
I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. On today's program, their boats are gone, their nets are gone, but their fear is ever present. Has an entire way of life been washed away with the tsunami?
Even if they give us boats and nets, with this situation, we are all fearful.
Also, one of the world's biggest killers of children that rarely makes headlines.
Last year, there were 6 cases of malaria in Florida, and that probably made bigger news than over 1 million kids a year dying in Africa.
We'll talk with a doctor who says a breakthrough in the effort to end malaria might be close. Plus, the story behind generations of girls in Mauritania forced to eat themselves into obesity and why that practice is falling out of favor. This is the World Vision Report. Many of the coastal villages destroyed by the tsunami depended on the ocean for their livelihoods. Generation after generation threw their nets out into the sea to put food on the table at home and to sell at market. But in the aftermath of the disaster, fishermen have not only lost their boats and nets, but their desire to go back to the sea. Gene Parker reports from the southeastern coast of India.
Survivors of the tsunami line up for a noonday meal in a refugee camp. As their names are called, they receive rice, a flatbread called chapatis, and on a good day, biscuits as well. About 100 flimsy tents made from old saris and pieces of wood stand on the sandy roadside. This is what remains of Semincheri, a fishing village in the state of Tamil Nadu, one of the worst-hit areas of India's southeast coast. People here have made a living from the sea for thousands of years. But as this fisherman explains, they now have no equipment to do that.
Boats, nets, everything got destroyed. If not fishing, what else is our employment?
The Indian central government says it's doing its best to help, but most people are skeptical about getting any aid to rebuild their lives. For one thing, many of the fishing families lived in huts next to the sea with no formal addresses. Even if they had identification papers, they were lost in the tsunami, so now they have no way of proving who they are and whether any claims for compensation are valid. In reality here, political favoritism and even religion and caste membership will likely determine whether a particular fisherman is able to receive compensation to replace his equipment and return to the sea. But the destruction of their boats and nets are not the only things keeping them from going back to the ocean. This 45-year-old fisherman explains.
Even if they give us boats and nets, with this situation, we are all fearful. We never had this kind of fear in our lives. We are very friendly to the sea. But after this, it is very difficult for us to re-enter it.
Further south in Tamil Nadu, the Nagapattinam district was one of the hardest hit areas on the Indian mainland. In the village of Chandrampati, a group of fishermen and women sit in a circle in what's left of a severely damaged house. Satyamurthy is about 17 years old, tall and lean. When Satyamurthy talks about the tsunami with others, he becomes agitated and can't seem to sit still.
Even after we go back to the sea, the trauma will always be there in our minds.
40-year-old Rajendra has been fishing more than 20 years.
Fear is still within all of us. A government official came here and said they will put something here to tell us about tsunamis. They said, don't worry, this thing won't happen again, so please go back. We will give you a danger signal. But I don't believe them.
And the women of this village have fears of their own. Satyamurthy's mother, Visanti, sits nearby. Her husband is a fisherman, and their house was totally destroyed in the tsunami.
I will always be thinking, what will happen to my husband if he's there in the sea, and the tsunami comes again? What will he do?
And even for those who've mustered up the courage to fish again, business is bad. There are rumors that the fish have eaten the human bodies swept out to sea, so many people won't eat fish now. Chronic unemployment in this region, even before the tsunami hit, left people here with only two options, fishing or migrating to huge urban slums to find menial employment. But some young people here hope for a third option. They say they will try to study as much as they can so they don't have to turn to the sea to make a living. The destroyed house this group has gathered in belongs to Chandra, a woman about 40 years old, whose husband is also a fisherman. She says she hears the waves of that terrible day in her head. Chandra agrees that education for the young must be a priority now.
We always did only fishing and we don't know any other work. But our children, let them study. Let them progress in life.
Given the trauma and economic loss these fishing villages have endured in the last few weeks, as well as the fear that remains in the young and old, it's possible that these communities and their way of life could be completely abandoned within a generation. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jean Parker in Tamil Nadu, South India. One of the more recent pieces I've done.
Thanks for playing that. And what's so good about that, it demonstrates all the things you were saying about the assistance, plugging in the visuals. It was excellent. It was a well done report, but it also illustrated some of the points you were making earlier. Thanks, Gene. I don't want to keep you here too long, but I think you had one more clip that you wanted to play, and you said you wanted to introduce it. And if you would introduce it and play it, I think that will be quite interesting to the audience.
Yeah, well, if you've been to India or if you've read anything about India, you know that religion is one of the most visible ways the most visible things, I guess I should say, that this society is based on. And so one of the things that happens, the major religious groups here are, of course, Hindus and Muslims. Hindus in the vast majority, but also Muslims are there. And so, of course, one of the things that happens is the call to prayers. And if you've been in the Arab world or traveled in Asia or North Africa, the call to prayers is very public, and it's done 5 times a day, of course, and it's done usually nowadays by loudspeaker from the mosque. Well, sometimes you can find a place where there are several or many mosques in a close proximity to each other. And so what you hear, and I heard this actually just by chance, and I was just really fascinated by it, and so I made a recording of it. And it's my favorite recording that I've made here in India. And so what you're going to hear are the voices of the imams doing their call to prayers. And the voices are at varying distances away from the microphone. You'll also hear the sounds of a neighborhood, which is where this is. This is in South India. And the mosques are all around. There's probably a dozen of them altogether that are somewhere in this brief clip I'm going to play. And so what you'll hear are a series of voices from different places, different mosques, doing the call to prayers in Arabic. And the voices seem to come together and weave in and out of each other, and occasionally they fall into a harmony. Sometimes they're discordant, sometimes they're in harmony. And to me, it's kind of metaphorical of the religious existence here in India, where a lot of times it's discordant. Once in a while it falls into harmony, but it's a very special sound and unusual, and it's one of my favorites. So do you have any questions about it before I play it?
No, we'll hold off on the questions until after the interview, Jean. Just play the clip. That would be great.
Okay, here we go. Sounds like unusual opportunity because it was fairly quiet. You did hear some insects. The piece of land I was standing on was forested, and so wildlife was there, and sounds from the neighborhood and so forth.
Well, that certainly was very unusual, Gene. I think we're going to open the session up to questions, but before we do that, Gene, I wanted to thank you for donating your time to FTP Presents, being so generous with me, with your time, and sharing your art, your talent, and your persona with the audience. I thank you very much. I think it was enlightening, it was interesting, And I wish you the best of luck in your future projects. Now, if there are any questions, I think Gene would be prepared to answer some of them.
Hello, Gene. My name is Donald. I'm from Texas. One of my question is, when you do a story like the tsunami stories, how do you separate your emotions from the story? How do you keep yourself together when you see these crises going on and you see the people in sorrow and pain and losing their villages and their fishing boats and so forth? Do you find yourself sometimes going back home and kind of releasing that stress after the story's over?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, sometimes, you know, I've done a lot of different jobs, and I guess to put it simply, I've seen a lot of bad things. And so I have quite a tolerance for being able to work with other people's tragedies and stay enough separated from them to be able to do my job. But yeah, I mean, I actually did three stories on this for these particular people on this topic, and I would say for a little while after that, you know, it was just like, oh, this just sucks. You know, this is this is just a bad thing. And but I guess it has to do with experience. Now, my translator was not able to always remain separate, and so she had some problems when we were doing the field work on this story and the other stories. So she had some difficulties there, but it's part of the job, and in order to get the job done, that's what you have to do.
Are there any other questions? And while you're thinking, I want to thank Michael for the behind-the-scenes arrangement to get Gene to appear, and I want to thank my good friend Dennis for the recording, and of course, we want to thank for the people for making this time available. Thank you, Jennifer. Are there any other questions?
No questions, Lou, but I just would like to thank Gene for this marvelous interview. It was just fascinating. I admire you, and to say it's great to have you back, Lou. It was a wonderful interview. Thank you both very, very much.
Thanks, Becky. Thanks for the kind words. Were there any other questions or comments? It's getting to be about, 1 o'clock there, Gene, in the morning?
Yeah, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning, and so I actually work a lot at night because a lot of the people that I work with are on the other side of the world from me, so it isn't late for me at all.
A big welcome back, Lou, and many thanks to Michael for great job coordinating. And Gina, I knew it would be a wonderful interview, and I just have to ask you, tell us how you got your FTP nickname.
Well, first of all, thank you, Jennifer, for all the work you do on this site. It's a wonderful site, and it's been a really important way for me to stay connected since I've been here and so forth. And so I've gotten a lot out of it. Kitty Cat 3000, well, I love cats, and 3000, I don't know where that came from. I think somebody maybe had Kitty Cat 2000 or something, and so I went to 3000. I don't remember any other conspiracy or methodology behind it.
You love cats, that's good enough for me. Great interview from a great lady. Thank you, Jean.
Hi, Jean. I'm Linda. I'm in South Portland, Maine, close to your hometown. I have a totally girly question. Do you dress in Western dress in India, or do you fall in with the Indians so you won't stand out and wear their dress?
I do not wear Western clothes here. First of all, they're uncomfortable. And yeah, there's certainly, especially in doing the kind of work I do, but also going to the villages and going to the countryside, Western dress would be inappropriate. It would be considered immodest. And so I think I have maybe one pair of jeans that don't fit me anymore, and that's about it. there are ways that that I have changed my lifestyle in order to fit in better, and some of them are gender related, some of them are actually quite interesting, and that's one of them. So and there are actually Native Indians who have a fairer complexion than I do as well. So I do look foreign, but I don't look that conspicuous.
Jean, you mentioned earlier in the interview that the electricity is on 21 hours a day. Does the city or town that you live in, do they purposely turn it off, or what happens?
Oh, nobody really knows. We're coming into summer now, and so most of the electricity here is provided by hydropower, so the lack of water is a problem. Sometimes we have a water problem, although in this building we have only had 2-3 times, I think, when we had a water problem. And we have a lift in this building, and so I'll tell you that another place I lived before was up 5 flights of steps, and so you had to haul water from the tanker, and so it's no picnic. But hopefully we won't have a water problem this year, because it causes all kinds of fights and problems and things. What were you asking me? Something about, it's a thing called load shedding, and it'll go off, it's supposed to go off at certain times, and those times are published in the paper and everything, but often it will go off whenever somebody feels like turning it off, I guess. And so you can't really count on those times for the electricity to come and go. So you always have to be prepared to not have electricity.
Gina, you didn't mention a guide dog. I assume you do not have one. Do many of the blind people there use a guide dog?
No, they don't. It's beginning to be discussed and experimented with, but it will be, I think, a tough thing to do. And I think it will be possible only in certain stratas of society, in certain places. Dogs are routinely abused in this country and are sort of considered the lowest of the low. And as you probably know, this is a very hierarchical society and very class conscious and caste conscious. And so there are some hazards with dogs in this country that would not be there for in the States or in Europe, for example, or in Japan. You could not have a dog that was in any way a scavenger because there's a lot of garbage around and a lot of trash and things that would not be good. And there are a lot of attitudinal difficulties with certain groups of people with dogs. So it would be very difficult. It would be tough. There are some people who are trying to see what happens, but you know, there's also something else, and that is the sheer lack of space. If you ride in an auto rickshaw, which is the most common form of public transport, also along with trains and buses, there just is no space. The local trains in this country are so crowded that you couldn't fall over if you wanted to. And so the sheer lack of space is a real problem in certain places. So I don't know. It's going to take some experimenting to find out if it's possible.
I should tell you, Becky, Jean omitted this, that she did use a guide dog for 10 years, but she doesn't use one now. And you, I guess the reasons are apparent.
I believe, Jean, you've also told me that there's often packs of wild starving dogs on the street, and so a guide dog would probably be very vulnerable to attack also.
Yes, and they're very territorial. So it's not unusual if you go out, especially at night, to be followed by 6 or 8 dogs. And they're extremely territorial, and they fight a lot. So, yeah, that thing is there, too.
Jean, this is Martin Webster from the UK. As I'm trained as an engineer, what type of motorbike do you have? And B, how well equipped are the blind schools over there, for instance, for IT technology?
I didn't get the first part of your question, but the idea of IT in the blind schools, I would say it varies a lot. I haven't been to a lot of the blind schools, but I've heard stories. And the ones that are the least equipped, you know, it might be some kind of a shelter or set of classrooms with some sort of accommodation for sleeping, very simple facilities and a very simple curriculum. Some of the schools in Bombay and Delhi have, and Bangalore especially, because Bangalore is a high-tech place, some of those schools might have some computers, might teach some rudimentary basic adaptive computer skills. But it seems to me that, of course, the issue is money, mostly. Money and also know-how, people that know how to teach the screen reading software. Mostly who's doing that, I think, are the private NGOs. So I don't think it's in the schools, really, but places like the National Association of the Blind and so forth, or some of the agencies, the adult agencies, rehabilitation places might have that.
What he wanted to know is the make and model of your motorbike.
Oh, it's a Kawasaki, and I'm not, I don't know the model off the top of my head, but my Jeep is a Mahindra 540.
Well, Jean, I really want to thank you for doing the interview. Lou, thank you very much for conducting it. And Dennis, thanks for recording it. It's been very entertaining.
Thanks again, Jean. I don't know you very well, but what I know, I like. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope people enjoy this. And if people have any other questions, they can let me know or send an email or something.
Did you want to give your email address?
Yeah, why not? As long as somebody doesn't put me on a spam list, disabilityradio@hotmail.com.
Jean, I have one more question for you. And in all your travels, when it's said and done, where would you most like to live in this world?
Well, right now, here, right here, where I am. I'm mostly very content here. There are some difficulties, and this is not easy by any means. It's not an easy thing to do. And there are some there are some days when this place is just too weird. But mostly I'm very contented here. And so, you know, unless something major changes, I guess I'll stay.